move, going deep, speed race. He's got Hill! He's got Hill!
From the Baptist Health Studios, inside the Baptist Health Training Complex, this is Drive Time with Travis Wingfield.
He's got it! Miami is in the playoffs!
What is up, Dolph fans, and welcome to the Drive Time Podcast. I am your host, Travis Wingfield, and on today's show, we flip it over to the defense to talk about some of the draft prospects that I like for both picks 21 and 55 in some respects. We'll go into the defensive line and look at a couple of players that could be in the mix for that first-round draft pick for your Miami Dolphins. Plus, the latest news, we'll talk about some of the Dolphins' re-signings they had this offseason and talk about how they fit into the fold. That and a whole heck of a lot more from the Baptist Health Studios inside the Baptist Health Training Complex. This is the Drive Time Podcast.
Let it drive first, down.
So this podcast will come out while I am in the dentist chair today. Have you guys ever lost a crown on a tooth? And have you ever done that by eating a Starburst? Ate a Starburst on Monday at 5:05, right after the dentist office closes, right? And it pulled the crown off my tooth. Now I have to go in and actually have a cavity filled in that spot and have a new crown made for that position. So yay, medical costs, right? But I'm doing that today. And speaking of dental work, did you guys see the news that came across right before I jumped on the podcast? Actually, inside information here, or inside baseball, I recorded the podcast and stopped it and started back over about a minute and a half in to talk about Stephon Diggs being traded away from Buffalo to the Houston Texans, per reports from Adam Schefter, Ian Rappaport, and the entire crew of insiders. And now all of a sudden, Buffalo has lost in consecutive years Isaiah McKenzie, Gabe Davis, and Stephon Diggs. And I wonder what that offense might look like in 2024, as they are the team that you were told all summer, or all winter, I should say, about Capopolips, right? And how it's coming for the Miami Dolphins. It was actually Buffalo that was in that cap hell, and they've taken a bath this offseason as a result and have not been able to make the additions the Miami Dolphins have made to their roster, with two teams that were both, you know, well over the cap going into the new league year, but Buffalo did not have the flexibility and structure ability, that's not a word, to remake themselves and get themselves competitive with, you know, in the offseason with more acquisitions and rounding out their roster with more new players that fit what they do. So no more Stephon Diggs in the division. And as we know, and Stephon tweeted this on Tuesday, are you sure that Josh Allen was a good player before I got there? And I'm not going to sit here and disparage Josh Allen because I know he's a great quarterback, but I think without Diggs, that offense really changes. I think now you're going to see a lot more 12 personnel with Dawson Knox there and Dalton Kincaid as kind of the top two options. And then what are they going to do? I guess probably two first-round draft picks. I'm assuming Texans gave up a first-round pick. We'll find out the compensation here, I'm sure, shortly. But if it's not a first-round pick, they're not going to be able to go up very high in the first round. And even if they can go up that high, I don't think they're going to be in range to get Neighbors, Marv, or Odunze. So what are we looking at here? Like Xavier Leggett? I like Xavier Leggett, but we'll see, man. I just don't think that that offense has the weapons, and that they've had their struggles throughout the course of the whole season last year, ups and downs offensively, except when they play Miami, it seems like. But different ball club up there in Buffalo. And I think they're going to be, you know, much worse for the wear this year than they were a season ago, just in terms of their overall roster and talent on that roster. So that's the big news of the day, that and my dental appointment. But I also wanted to check in with a couple of more news points here. That Tua Tagovailoa has in fact hired a quarterbacks coach, Tom House, who's worked with a lot of the great legendary quarterbacks, including Drew Brees. And I think this was overdue for Tua. We know that he works with Nick Hicks in the offseason, the great trainer over there at Perform, who works with a bunch of NFL athletes and athletes alike. And that's all for Tua's body and conditioning and all the physical stuff, right? But now he has the quarterback coach to really help him kind of take that next step. And he was really the only quarterback in the NFL that did not have that. And so I'm glad that he's you know, bridged that gap and put himself in position to learn more about the craft of his game, because we've seen what he can do. And I talked about on the podcast on Monday with the quarterbacks in this year's class. And I just watched some more Drake May and watched him try to fit these anticipation balls into, you know, three-man windows, and it's like, ooh, he can't do that, can he? Tua is very good at that. So Tua taking those skills to a quarterback coach and refining them even more, I really, really like the idea of that, and I'm glad it's finally happened here for Tua. Last thing I wanted to talk about, have you guys seen Jalen Phillips's like Instagram and his workout videos this offseason? This is not breaking news or anything, but just letting you guys know, I would be very, very surprised if JP is not on the field week one this year. He is that type of recovery guy. He is that type of workout guy. And I think that he'll be in position to be back and help our pass rush along with Shaq Barrett from week number one. So that's the big news of the day. Wow, a lot of stuff there on the podcast. I wasn't even intending to get into that stuff. And we're already, what, 5 minutes into the show here. And, you know, I have a whole segment here I want to talk about with the Dolphins' approach to free agency and the re-signing of our own guys because, you know, we talked about Raheem Mostert at length on the Monday podcast and the benefit of continuity of this Dolphins' run game, and he's not the only re-signing. And quite frankly, we haven't done a lot on those guys. That's why I wanted to pull up Braxton Berrios, River Craycraft, Savon Ahmed, Elijah Campbell, Robert Jones, Kendall Lamb, and Jake Bailey. And I think that this continues the theme of frugality the team has shown this offseason and really awaited for the right opportunity to spring into action and stretch the idea of frugality just a little bit, i.e. Kendall Fuller. It's not, you know, going to the top of the market on Monday with that first signing and being like, look at what we did. We moved all this money around to sign one player who can impact the game in one way at one position. Like, they didn't do that. And that's what good teams have not done for a long time. I think that for Kendall Fuller, you know, like a weekend of free agency, you bring him in, you tack on some void years, you find a way to be creative with the cap. I don't think most people were expecting a cornerback, much less the top one that was available, maybe outside of L'Jarius Sneed, who wasn't exactly available. I mean, he was, but you had to give up draft compensation to make that happen. And the Dolphins then go out and snag, you know, Kendall Fuller, who's not just awesome, but I can't stress this enough. But when you have two players like we do now with Ramsey and Fuller, it changes everything the DC can do from a structure standpoint, from a disguise standpoint. And gosh, I can't wait to see what Coach Weaver has in store. The man has an aura, by the way, that you can just pick up from the other side of the room. That smile of his, like, I think that he's going to really capture the imagination and the attention of his players, much in the way Mike McDaniel does, but in like a different way, if that makes sense, because he's more like physically imposing. He has the player background, but gosh, he just has an aura that commands your attention. Back on task here, I kept thinking about the quote unquote TED talk, and I use air quotes for an audio platform that makes a bunch of sense, right? But I use those air quotes because it was just a Q&A or like a panel in a more relaxed setting, kind of like a live podcast, but it was Eric DaCosta, the personnel man over there, the GM, right, of the Ravens, talking about Ravens principles and philosophies and examples of how they do their business, and a pretty damn good team to take a cue from. And he was talking about how we want to re-sign our own guys, and it's like, yeah, but Eric, you guys also just saw four players from your 2020 rookie class exit. So, like, it's not necessarily your core principle, is it? But in this, he was talking about how the Ravens aren't typically free agent spenders. And man, I challenge anybody out there to find me a team that went ham in free agency and had it like work out, right? I'm not talking about like a lot of signings, but those top of the market moves, the Ndamukong Suhs, the Mike Wallaces of the world. We know from firsthand experience how that goes most of the time, right? But there really are two good options for teams that used free agency to propel a championship run or a run to the title game, I should say. The 2015 Broncos did this, and the 2021 Cincinnati Bengals did this. The latter notoriously avoids spending money on anything, much less free agency, like the plague. But look at what Denver did that year they went to the Super Bowl and won it. Tight end Owen Daniels, guard Evan Mathis was at the end of his time, but they were the big prizes in free agency that year. And that was a year after they brought in TJ Ward, and he was a big hit for their defense. But what do all of those guys have in common? They were top players at positions that just don't cost that much, not the prohibitive price tag of an edge or a corner or a wide receiver. But guess what they did at those spots? They kind of did what Miami just did, and they found bargains. Like DeMarcus Ware was at the end of his career, so he was 3 for $30 million. Can you imagine a pass rusher getting that much money today that can produce like DeMarcus Ware did, even in his Denver days? They also got Aqib Talib and Emmanuel Sanders, and just like Evan Mathis and Owen Daniels, they were cheaper. So DeMarcus Ware, end of his career, 3 for $30 million. Talib was entering his age 29 season, just like Kendall Fuller. That deal was 6 for $57 million. You don't see six-year contracts anymore, but that's less than $10 million a year. It's right in line with Kendall Fuller's money. Then Emmanuel Sanders, when they already had Demaryius and Wes, kind of like we have Reek and Waddle, Odell Beckham visit. I mean, the similarities are uncanny. Sanders' contract was 3 for $15 million, so it wasn't this top-of-the-market receiver they brought in, right? How about that Bengals team I referenced earlier? How does a team that historically has not spent a dime in free agency turn a free agent class into a Super Bowl caliber defense? I know Joe Burrow gets a lot of the headlines for that run they had in 2021, but the truth is that defense kind of held the Raiders, kind of held the boat together there. They held the Raiders to 19 points in the wild card round. They turned over Tannehill 3 times and sacked him 8 times in a 19-16 divisional round win. I hate when people do this, but I'm going to do it anyways. If Tua won a playoff game like that, he would get no credit for it. Just going to tell you that right now. Now, he did have a great comeback in the AFC Championship game over Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs, 27-24. So you got to give him his flowers for that. That's a legacy game and a legacy win. But I'm just saying, defensively, that team, they carried the team to the Super Bowl that year, and it was done largely through free agency. They signed Chidobe Awuzie, Mike Hilton, that's a perimeter and a slot cornerback. But Awuzie was not like some Nnamdi Asamoah or Byron Jones tier signing. He was 3 for 21, $7 million per year. It's kind of Kendall Fuller's category, isn't it? Chidobe Awuzie was, Hilton was 4 for 24, so $6 million per year. That's like what you pay a top safety in today's NFL, but he's a slot cornerback, and that's kind of like, that's what Kenny Moore got, right? So pretty good for a slot, but isn't that exactly what we just discussed? Being able to buy the best players at some of the cheaper position groups, and then you draft the premium spots like a Jalen Phillips, like a Jalen Waddle, like a Tua Tagovailoa, like an Austin Jackson. You get where we're going with all this. So for that Bengals team, Larry Ogunjobi was a one year, $1.4 million signing. Eli Apple was 1 year, $1.2 million. They brought in Riley Reiff, a mid-market tackle, for 1 year for $7.5 million. And then they had their big splash in Trey Hendrickson. But what's really interesting about Hendrickson's deal, 4 for 60, is that Carl Lawson, who was kind of on the same track as Hendrickson at that stage of their career, he left the Bengals to go to the Jets on 3 for 45, which is the exact same APY as Hendrickson, right? So they fancied an imported player over the guy they developed, and gosh, that worked out big time. Trey has 40 sacks in those 3 years. Lawson has just 7. He did miss one full season, but that's part of the game. Why am I telling you all of this? Why does this have to do with the Miami Dolphins, Travis? Well, it's because I believe the best teams treat free agency this way. And the ones that have turned free agency into a major part of a championship contending team are the ones who scour the fringes. You don't see them shopping at the top 10 portion of the best free agents available list on NFL.com, on ProFootballFocus.com, whatever the case may be. I don't know. I think there's a reason you see teams coming off 3, 4, 5, 6 win seasons tend to occupy that space. They have cap space because they don't have anybody worth paying, and so they have to go out and overpay a guy for 30 cents on the dollar production in the free agent market. That's Gucci and Louis portions of free agency, and I can get you the bag that performs the exact same function at Target, and you can remove 2 zeros from the price tag. Does that connect with you guys? That's where Miami went this offseason, an approach of frugality. And we're going to come back on the next segment here on the podcast and talk about the players they signed and brought in and how it fits and matches this idea of being frugal and how it can be beneficial to bring in these back end of the roster guys back to your team who you know can perform in certain roles at a certain cost. That's all next. Drive Time Podcast, your host, Travis Wingfield, brought to you by AutoNation.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
We left off last segment talking about the frugal nature of the Dolphins' free agency approach and finding players within your own ecosystem that provide more value to you than they might on the open market. And look, we keep talking about the Buffalo Bills. That's the big news of the day, with Stephon Diggs going to the Houston Texans for a draft pick trade. I don't have compensation on that at the time of the taping for you guys, but look, I look at it this way, that the Dolphins, I think, in this move have closed the gap on Buffalo a little bit more. I thought last year the Dolphins were the better football team that just kind of had some bad breaks with injuries and how the schedule played out and a couple of plays here and there that went the wrong way against their favor down the stretch that cost them a division championship. Because otherwise, on balance all year, I thought Miami was a far superior team to what the Buffalo Bills were. And hopefully without Stephon Diggs, you know, it kind of looks like that's going to be a gap that gets closed even more. In fact, now we do have trade compensation for this. So Buffalo receives a second round pick from the Minnesota Vikings, and the Texans receive Stephon Diggs and a sixth round pick and a fifth round pick for 2025. So Buffalo gets a second round pick from the Vikings in the Stephon Diggs trade, which means they're not going to be able to go up very high in the first round and get his replacement. So you're probably looking at the top receiver in Buffalo this year being picked, pick 20 or 22 or something like that, in that range from where they got from their own draft pick, I should say, that's in the early 20s, that probably going to be a rookie receiver there to replace Stephon Diggs. So that's going to be their top guy, but it's not going to be Stephon Diggs, I can tell you that much. So back to the Dolphins and their approach to free agency and why, you know, their approach to frugality and to keeping players, you know, keeping their books flexible to sustain the success we've seen from both Buffalo and Miami the last few years in the regular season hasn't translated to playoff success for us or championship success for them. But Buffalo's in this situation now where they're going to have to kind of retool and refigure things to work out how those books kind of got tangled up, because Miami isn't in that position, right? And you can listen to Capopolis guy all you want, who told you that this Dolphins team was not going to be able to be aggressive and make moves in free agency. Doesn't understand what he's talking about, but you can look at Buffalo, and that's kind of what he was going for when he had that idea there. So Miami, their ability to make moves and add players and be, you know, take advantage of market disadvantages for other teams and attack free agency that way and bring back their own guys on, you know, cheap price tags on the back end of the roster. That's what I like about this Dolphins approach this offseason. It allows them to be good in 2024 and continue to have success down the road, hopefully for years to come. So I wanted to take a look at some of these signings Miami made to bring back their own guys. We haven't talked about them much besides like Raheem Mostert, but Braxton Berrios is where I'll start right here, because I am curious how the new return game kickoff return rules plays into Braxton's role for the Miami Dolphins. I know he's about as reliable of a punt returner as you can ask for. I thought he was fantastic with his decision-making in terms of fair catches or when to not call a fair catch, because if you call a fair catch, you can't go block somebody. If you don't call the fair catch, you can go make a block. And he makes that decision really well every time, to where he gets that extra 2 seconds on that block to allow the football to trickle its way into the end zone. And now you start to drive at the 20-yard line opposed to the 5 or the 2 or the 1, whatever the case may be. But he's a set-and-forget return man, but he's not going to give you any explosive plays that way. The same thing on offense, not going to give you an explosive element on offense. To me, I think the receiver gambit is kind of up there. Like I said last year, I don't think that's really his game. He's a punt returner, and your salary and your contract should reflect that, right? So I think that I like this returning acquisition or returning player incumbent, if it's just for returning punts. But even then, it's like, you know, if someone can beat him out for that role, I'm not opposed to that either. River Craycraft, speaking of trustworthy, if I need a receiver at a 12-yard curl landmark in 1.9 seconds, not 1.8, not 2.0, that's where I know I can find River. He's going to catch everything you throw to him. He's a veteran voice that's beloved in the locker room, and he gets after it on special teams as well. Go Cougs! But like Braxton, some similar limited explosiveness in terms of how he can help your receiving core catch footballs and move down the field. But he can't play on the perimeter, which is something that Braxton doesn't really do. So there is that for River Craycraft. So I've always called Savon Ahmed a perfect like third or fourth back, probably the fourth back on the roster, because he's going to be awesome for you on special teams when the rest of the room is healthy. And then if you need him to step up when there's some injuries for offensive usage, you can throw him swings and screens and rails and wheels, and you can hand it off to him, and he can make a man miss, like the scoring run he had against Buffalo in 2022. Also, would you believe me if I told you that Savon is tied for the fifth longest tenured player here? He came in the same year as Tua, Austin, and Blake, and only Durham, Sealer, and Sanders have been here longer. So that's fourth, actually, right? But kind of like the other two guys, limited explosiveness in terms of the big playability. It is Ahmed's, I think, downfall. But for the most part, you know what you're getting there with Savon Ahmed. He's a very valuable piece of the roster. I think Rob Jones is similar in terms of what he offers. I think we learned a lot about Rob Jones last year, because this system traditionally hasn't catered to maulers like Rob. That's kind of his game. But damn it if he didn't show you that he could get his work done in space enough while also providing some much-needed muscle inside when we did go power. I go back to the Cowboys game, and he was a critical piece of some critical runs there from Jeff Wilson to win that game. I still think his tackle tape from 2021 is good enough that if you need him in a pinch, he can play in that position, and that means he can play multiple spots, a lot like the guy we just signed in Jack Driscoll. I still don't think he's athletic enough to be a 1,000-snap guard in this offense and really give you what this offense needs, but I think he's a very good you know, sixth or seventh offensive lineman in swing positions at multiple spots across the offensive line. Elijah Campbell might be the best special teams player on the damn team from a coverage standpoint. I love his tackling on the ball and sub packages, and smart players who really take good care of their body and have the same level of professionalism and how they prepare. I like guys like that on the back end of the roster because I know they're going to kind of, you know, rise all boats, whatever you call it. He just is the kind of professional you want in your building. Probably don't want to be in a position where he starts several games for you at safety, but he can play there in a pinch. And like I said, very valuable special teamer here for Elijah Campbell. And then we got Kendall Lamb signing back with the Miami Dolphins. I mean, talk about the ultimate find. I referenced the 32 snaps he played from 2022 like all the time, and he really carried that over into a very, very effective replacement for Teron Armstead when he was down last year, and you've needed that these last 2 years, right? So Miami with Kendall Lamb, with Keon Smith, who I think has a chance to become a player, and even like Ryan Hayes, a seventh-round draft pick last year, like there's some tackle depth here, which you have to have if you're going to have Teron Armstead as your starting left tackle. So hopefully there's some some ability here with Kendall Lamb, the proven veteran, and then some developmental guys and Keon Smith and Ryan Hayes behind him. But Kendall just gives you a level of comfort in terms of your depth. You know that if you have to plug him in a pinch, you're going to be just fine there with Kendall Lamb. Jake Bailey, the stats aren't great. The best stat I have for him is that 37.7% of his punts wound up inside the 20-yard line, and he also allowed some of the fewest punt return yardage last year. But that's because the kicks didn't go very far, right? But he was not top 20 in gross or net and any of that stuff. So Jake Bailey back here as the punter for the 2024, I should say, Miami Dolphins. But the value of players like this, I mean, none of these guys were starters a year ago, right? They played most of their reps on special teams or in sub packages when we were banged up at certain spots. Savon, Brax, Riv all had some reps otherwise, and Robert Jones started a lot of games, but when the roster was healthy, we're talking about fourth and fifth wide receivers, third and fourth running backs, swing backups on the offensive line, dime safeties, right? And when you pack your roster full of cheap production in those roles, that's how you can balance the need to pay for your star quarterback, your game-changing wide receivers, your blossoming edge rusher who was an Achilles injury away from truly breaking through with a double-digit sack season last year and earning his place, in my opinion, among the top 10 edge rushers. So that money for those guys has to be saved up and budgeted for, and you get there by your frugal nature in the offseason and by bringing back players, 40 through 53 on contracts like this who are reliable, dependable, and give you a sense of continuity there. Before we continue here into the final segment talking about some college players, I have some more just details I wanted to talk about with you guys. And I went back and watched some Odell Beckham tape, who was here for a visit a couple weeks back, and the Dolphins remained interested in his services. And I think signing Beckham gives you a ton of flexibility. I would still be very much in favor of a receiver like at pick 55. I think pick 55 is going to have really good receivers available that can come in and be a productive players in year one. But Odell Beckham is that too. And I put some notes down here of his tape. Great balance, great control, great footwork at the top of the route still today at this point of his career with a very, very springy step out of the breaks. He is a willing blocker. In fact, he hit a key block on a long Zay Flowers touchdown catch and run on a screen pass that got called back, but he was the focal point of that block. The long speed has decreased a little bit since his prime, but he still does have that gear to accelerate past the flat-footed cornerback. And the way that Tua, anticipates even he's leaving type of deep shots, like I think it really fits, especially on the perimeter. And what I like most about that, hang on, let's come back to that actually. Let's come right back to that. There's a couple of things that his release package, I thought, is very, very good release package. You're not going to press this guy very effectively, especially on the perimeter against press. And then the ability to stack from that position. He can get on top of guys and make them have to wait until he makes his decision and declare their route before they can jump that route and make that play. A couple things I didn't love is, and this is what you're going to have to contend with this player if you bring him in, is the body language. He would throw up mailboxes when he thought he was open, which would cost him a half a step on these deep balls, and that can play a big difference. I thought his frustration was displayed when he didn't get the ball on a couple of deep throws that Lamar Jackson did not target him with. That's part of like the diva receiver, right? You know the whole experience there, and you're going to get that with some of these guys. But the route running he has reminds me kind of Tyreek or of Waddle or of Jonnu Smith, these guys they keep bringing in the sense that they don't shortcut the details in their route running, and that helps expand the defense and the way the concepts are designed to do it. He has the nuance in his game to get his route when it's explicitly taken away. Like you're playing outside leverage and I want to run an out route, he can still do that. But also, when to throttle his tempo in order for the rest of the concept to work, i.e. don't blow by a two-man bracket and let their attention go elsewhere. He's shifty with the football in his hands. He can make guys miss. He catches a speed out against off cover three and then makes the cornerback miss and gets 15 more yards. Did we have anybody else on the roster outside of 10 and 17 that could do that last year? No. And speaking of those guys, when you put Odell on the perimeter and he can get vertical and be a threat to throw those early vertical shots on the perimeter, now all of a sudden, you open up space for Reek or Waddle to play from a nasty split or a slot condensed split or a backfield split, whatever the case may be. You now have more flexibility because you have that perimeter threat who can win vertically. Cedric Wilson wasn't doing that. Braxton Berrios wasn't doing that. River Craycraft wasn't doing that. Chase CFL Claypool wasn't doing that. You need another guy to really help Tyreek and Waddle get the most of their game, and that's what I think that he can do. He's quick enough to win double moves and releases to get on top of guys. I really liked Odell Beckham's tape at this stage of his career, provided the money is right. So I would be all in on that acquisition. I hope that it does happen. I wanted to give you guys a couple of fan feedback notes here because I saw questions about it on Twitter, and I want to do more to incorporate your guys' voice on the show here. So first, Eric Volker asked me, why did you mention you didn't like Keon Coleman's game, the Florida State receiver? Dude, I'm all about speed and explosiveness and get out of your breaks as a receiver because I think it's the only way you can consistently win at this level. He kind of reminds me of Kelvin Benjamin. Doesn't really turn all that well. The route running is not very crisp. He can learn that stuff, but I just don't think it's going to work, number one. And number two, it's a terrible fit for what this offense is because you need to be precise and quick and in and out of your breaks, and that's just not his game. That's why, like Chase Claypool, that route against the Buffalo Bills, look, there's discourse about that route for months and probably the next year. Horrible route. Not a great decision to throw the football. I think there wasn't anything else open, and you should be able to throw the ball to your primary when he's in a spot where he's going to require a crisp route. But that route was atrocious, and that's why I see from some of these receivers like a Keon Coleman, I don't think the route running is that good. Last thing I wanted to address here was I saw some notes and feedback on my running game rant the other day, the discourse about when to and when not to run the football. And I just want to mention, like, I get where you guys are coming from the short yardage situations, because I think there was times last year where Coach McDaniel could have just gone to the running game. But I will never, like, I don't know. I give him the benefit of the doubt in the sense that, like, this offense is really good, right? It's effective. It's explosive. It scores. It gains yards. It keeps the defense off the field. But yeah, you could do more to extend drives. But like, if I get Tyreek one-on-one in a short yard situation, like, I want to throw him the football. And I also am a big subscriber to the idea that third and one or fourth and one are some of your best opportunities for explosive splash plays because the roof of the defense comes off, and that's where you can get the big splash plays. And if you don't hit them, you turn the ball over, sure. But I'm never one to just say run the ball every time, because sometimes looks dictate that. And I get you want to be a team that can be physical and bruise your way to a first down when they know it's coming anyway. And McDaniel would agree with that, I think. He said as much in his press conferences. But I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that this whole idea of run the ball 35, 40 times a game, that's not why. Why would you do that? Why would you take the ball out of Jalen Waddle and Tyreek Hill's hands and Tua Tagovailoa's hands? Like, I get the short yardage stuff. I understand. I get when teams dictate the terms against you, run the football more. Should have ran the ball more in the second half of the Buffalo game. But on balance, McDaniel's offensive passing and running game balance has been really good. Situationally, I will concede that it could be better in those spots, just so we're all on the same page there. All right, let's go ahead and take our last break right there. Come back and finish up some college scouting notes. That's next. Drive Time Podcast, your host, Travis Wingfield, brought to you by AutoNation.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
College football. I want to talk about, we're going to do a mock draft roundup on the Friday podcast, taking a look at some of the experts' mock drafts out there. But I'm getting deeper and deeper into my college study right now. And without Christian Wilkins and with the acquisitions of Benito Jones, who I think is a 15 snap per game nose tackle, run defender only, or Jonathan Harris, who to me is depth in that position, or Neville Gallimore, who's also depth in that position, you could still stand to add an interior player on the defensive line. And the good news is I think you're going to have two guys on the board at pick 21 that are really good. And here's the thing. Here's the thing about that. Both players that could be on the board right there might have been last year, not just this year, last year, the best interior pass rusher on the football team. I know you're going to say that's crazy because we had guys that had basically 20 combined sacks in 92 and 94 in Salt and Pepper. But, dude, I'm telling you, Johnny Newton and Byron Murphy can freaking play. Let's go ahead and continue this thought here. If it's interior pass rush chops you desire in this year's class, you have come to the right place because the options to fill that void are significant. Yes, Christian did leave to Las Vegas and took 9 sacks with him, but I also think that a lot of that pass rush production came from the scheme and the many, many, many bodies caught by Zach Sealer on pick stunts. Please do not take this as me taking away from Christian Wilkins. I mean, look what he got paid. We know how good he is. He's a great football player, one of the best in the National Football League, but I think there's an opportunity for somebody alongside Zach Sealer, who's been every bit as good over the years, to have those same opportunities. I mean, look no further than his sack production last year. Zach has been so consistent for us. And when I think back to Christian's rookie year and his draft profile, pass rush polish was not one of the things that scouts wrote about in terms of areas, or was one of the things people wrote about that he could grow with. It wasn't his bread and butter just yet, right? And he did that. That's what development's all about. But man, when I watch two of these guys that could be on the board at pick 21, there is some accomplished looking pass rush arsenals and I think could be better developed than what you typically get from a rookie defensive tackle, even in the first round. And I start with Illinois' Johnny Newton, Jerzon Newton. There are wins from every damn position for this guy. He has a sack versus the Gophers, the Golden Gophers, at the 4 technique. That's head up over the tackle where the right guard squeezes the B gap, which is the second gap from the center between the guard and the tackle, and forces Newton into an edge rush around the tackle who knows he has inside post help. So the only vulnerability you have is your outside post. So Johnny, who the thing is Johnny, takes a crossover step that's in sync with his double-handed swipe and just renders the right tackle's hands completely useless. I don't know if you've ever played offensive line, but try doing it without your hands. If you tie Richmond Webb's hands behind his back, I could get a sack on him. Probably not, but you get it. My point is when a rusher can marry his footwork with his hands and his rush moves, that's when you get the momentum of push-pull element of the game. That's the entire definition of playing on the line. You have to get the offensive line going one way and then cross over before he can redirect and beat him to the spot. Then from that spot, Newton just runs the arc and then flattens the quarterback like an edge rusher who leaves the pocket and Newton still tracks him down for the sack. That single rep told me this guy is a first-round draft pick. I saw him run a rep from the 4-eye. That's the same position, but you're a little bit more inside on the inside shoulder of the tackle opposed to being head up against him, where he runs a jab step and then stab swims, then suddenly gets the right guard extended with one arm and grabs on for the hold. Just immediate dispatching, like in a phone booth. When you can win that quickly in that small area of space, that's special. Now, this is where it gets really wild. Condense him down to the zero technique. Let's head up over the center, your nose tackle. Like, have mercy, man. Who can play those that many roles? Wilkins didn't really even do that often. So I'm not sure what this move is called, but it's a deke of sorts. When a defensive tackle wants to hold his ground, he'll usually shoot the hands and try to gain control of the offensive line's chest plate so he can take him where he wants to go, then disengage when the play comes his way. And on this one, Johnny shoots his hands wide, and it gets the offensive line to really throw his hands and get out over his skis. Then Newton immediately hits him with the arm over, aided by a rip. And I mean, this is a beeline to the quarterback from the A-gap in less than a second. You cannot win offensively when you have that type of disruption on the defensive side of the football. I got to be honest with you guys, I'm not so sure Newton isn't the best interior rusher on the team if he's here this year or last year. I've said it already. I'll say it again. But Travis, what about the run game? Well, they work together, you see, because he generates all the power he has in his lower half because of really, really good technique. Like, you watch the sideline angle, and he's just dog-walking guys with knockback. Go back and watch the Iowa game, a team that plays with 17 players within 2 yards of the football and runs it 98 times per game, or watch him go blow up Olufoshanu, the top 10 pick of Penn State, on a 4th and down and get a TFL. Like, he's a fun tape, man. 725 snaps each of the last 2 years. I like him. He's my DT1. And then I turned on Byron Murphy from Texas. Now I have a debate in my head. Newton didn't work out in Indy, but Murphy did. And his relative athletic scorecard is all green except for height, weight, and bench. That means he's 80th percentile or better in every metric, including 93rd percentile with a 33-inch vertical at 300 pounds and 95th percentile and 40-yard dash at 4.1. at 297 pounds. It's crazy. Now, I will give the edge in the run game between Murphy and Newton to Murphy. I think Newton gets the pass rush gold there, but some of the reps I loved, a zero technique against Alabama where the play flows front side to get knocked back on the guard, and he sees the center coming from his peripheral and wants to attach in that double team, so he drops to the knee, which is called a make a pile. Like, get on a knee, pile up that double team, and let your linebackers go make a play. But he winds up splitting the double team. I've never seen a 300-pound man get off the ground like that, and so the relative athletic scorecard kind of tracks because he can go to a knee and get back up and still make the play. He tackled the ball carrier. Here's what I'm having a hard time understanding. He's 300 pounds doing this against 320-pound guards, 310-pound centers. Those jobs are usually reserved for guys that are closer to 330 and up. That athletic ability and change of direction shows up as a pass rusher too, because he can whip your guard and center from the two technique. Hell, I saw him beat both against Washington in the Sugar Bowl on the same rep, beat your guard and your center. I don't know who I prefer. I don't think I really have one yet. I probably lean a little bit towards Newton, but it kind of depends on what you want. But like the explosiveness and pop of Newton, but damn it if Murphy doesn't open up so much more, because you can put Zach freaking Sealer next to him, and those two guys, they would be just physically imposing with how much power they play with. Either of those two guys, Newton or Murphy at 21, is a great pick. If I had to stack them, the next one's probably Braden Fisk, but he's got short arms. He is shot out of a cannon when he gets off the line of scrimmage, and that's where his workout metrics were all across the board fantastic. 20th best combine for a defensive tackle ever out of over 1,700 prospects. 95th percentile in just about everything or better. But when he has to redirect and make a secondary move, he just doesn't really have a whole lot of juice. Their short arms will do that. So I think the difference with Fisk and then Murphy and Newton is that Fisk has that first step get off gold medal, but I think that Murphy and Newton have a lot more secondary juice and just overall ability to win with football technique. So good year to need a defensive tackle, and Miami does, and this is a group of guys they could choose from. I did want to get into DBs here, but we're going to go ahead and bump it to the Friday podcast because we're already past time. So I want to go ahead and just close with a player who I absolutely love. I've seen every game he's played, but now I've seen him on tape too and like him even more. Washington State's safety, Jaden Hicks, who is easily safety one for me, and it's not that close. Think Brandon Jones' skill set, but like way better. Like more explosive, more ball skills, the ability to squat and reroute and trail technique and pass coverage, which Jones can never really do, and run with some of those dangerous passing game weapons, but also come downhill and set the temperature in your locker room. The other guy I watched was Michigan's Mike Sandrastil, who's a nickel cornerback, but that lends itself to some safety play as well. Just such a damn good football player. There's a theme for safeties and DBs with me. I like guys that play the position like a quarterback and can anticipate what's going to happen. Like, that's these guys in terms of Hicks and Sandrastil. But they're also, again, temperature changers. They just bring a level of intensity to every practice that turns things up a little bit and bring a presence to your locker room as well. So there you go. A little bit of everything on this podcast. We're going to continue doing these draft podcasts, some of my thoughts and rants. You guys write into the show and let me know what you want to hear about. I'll talk about it here on the podcast here as we get closer and closer to draft day at the end of the month. In the meantime, that is going to be my time. You all please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, follow me on social at Wingfield NFL. Follow the team at Miami Dolphins. Check out the Fish Tank podcast with Seth and Juice. Check out the YouTube channel for media availabilities, Dolphins Today, my free agent interviews with all the new free agent acquisitions, and so much more. And last but not least, MiamiDolphins.com. Until next time, fins up. Caroline and Cameron, daddy's coming home.